Hiya, Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark's Architecture and Morality. All songs are by Andy McCluskey and Paul Humphries. Architecture and Morality was released on 6th of November 1981 on Din Disc. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hiya, and welcome to a very special episode of Tim's Listening Party with me, Tim Burgess, where I sit down with an artist to play back a classic album together. So far, we've had listening parties with Tears for Fears, Catatonia, Deacon Blue, Simple Minds, Sleeper and Buzzcocks, and many more. If you've missed any, make sure to catch up on Tim's Listening Party podcast. Make sure you tweet me your thoughts at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. This episode, I'm joined by lead singer and bassist of one of the most influential synth-pop acts in history, pioneers of electronic music, OMD, or Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, were one of the earliest synthesizer-led bands to emerge from the post-punk scene, influencing many artists since and making their presence felt in the second British invasion in the US with the advent of MTV. Simply put, OMD are partly responsible for the sound that defined the 80s. And as I mentioned at the start, this is a very special episode because it's not being broadcast on the radio. It was recorded in front of a live audience recently. It's Andy McCluskey.
Good evening.
Man of the moment.
Well, thank you very much. I tell you what, I've been rather busy the last few weeks. I seem to have become a victim of releasing a very well-received new album.
I believe so.
Although you haven't heard it yet, you've only heard a few tracks.
So, Bauhaus Staircase.
It's a typical OMD title, isn't it, that, for an album?
Yeah, it's funny.
Not at all pretentious.
No, I when I was speaking to friends that I was going to be doing this, people in the industry and stuff, they were saying what an amazing album it is. You know, it's like, oh my god, it's so great. So how did you, you know,
have you got a copy there or somebody nicked it? Did you have a copy lying around? Was it on the other side of your chair? There you go. There it is,
unopened actually.
Yeah, so I mean, it effectively it probably wouldn't exist if it wasn't for COVID, because there was nothing else to do for most of a couple of years.
Right.
And I was I was just bored, rigid. Couldn't go out, couldn't visit anything, do anything. So I just dived back into my computer and went, right, there's nothing else to do. I shall be creative. And it was, I mean, I'm amazed, actually, at what we managed to come up with. And I'm very happy with it. And without sounding big-headed, literally every journalist I've done an interview with in the last 3 weeks has prefaced it by going, what an amazing album. So
it's amazing when you can actually say that, you know. I mean,
I'm still too close to it. I can't be objective, but it's nice when you get feedback from other people and they say, yeah, you've done a great job.
So you've had like 3 songs playlisted on the radio and stuff?
We're realistic. We've released 3 tracks. I don't even call them singles anymore. We've just released 3 tracks and we had some great videos with them, and it's been good. And there's going to be one more, I think, on the day of the album release.
Yeah, it's a great title, Bauhaus Staircase. Great sleeve. Sounds very healthy.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, in the end, Paul and I said we were not going to release anything if it wasn't good enough. And the previous album, Punishment of Luxury. What's interesting, when we did the listening party with you during lockdown for Punishment of Luxury, that's when I kind of started to realise, actually, people treat this album like it's possibly in our top 3 we've ever released. They talk about it like it's up there with Architecture and Morality and Dazzleship. So Paul in particular was like, we're not releasing anything if it's not as good as Punishment of Luxury. I said, trust me, it's okay. I think Paul just wanted a holiday. He didn't want to do any work, you know. So I just kept saying, no, it'll be great. It'll be great. We'll just keep working on it. Come back from France. Stop being on holiday.
Did you find doing those listening parties, you know, gave you more of an insight to the connection that you have with your fans and stuff?
Do you know what? Well, I don't do Twitter myself. Yeah. I use other people to do social media. But that was going live on that.
Yeah.
was really, really enjoyable and exciting. And you know, I think it was Ed at our label 100% said, Tim Burgess is doing this amazing thing on Twitter, and you know, would you like to do what you know? And so after you said yeah, because you knew the album because you've been on the journey with us from when you were a teenager.
Yeah,
and it was really enjoyable. It was great to. It's a bit like doing a live gig, you know. You're in the moment with people and you're getting their feedback immediately. It's not just like, you know, you sold them the record then you never find out how they responded to it. So I absolutely love those playback
parties. That's good
parties,
to know.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
It's great. Even though you were at the bus stop when we were doing the Dazzle Ships.
I did.
Well, which you let on afterwards.
I know, but I mean, I got. So, it's for me, like, at the very beginning, it was the hardest thing I'd ever done, you know, really, to sort of like work out how to organise these listening parties and, you know, find a shape for it that, you know, because it had not really been done, so, you know. So, but by, you know, halfway through, I was just like, I could do them anywhere, really, you know.
You were just dialing it in.
Apart from the bath, because it's not very good having a phone in the bath, you know.
No, but listen, I was delighted. And we did six.
You did six.
We did six, which was amazing. Yeah, yeah. And I loved every minute. And it was, as you say, it was a great opportunity to get some real-time feedback from people who you don't always get to meet or hear from. So it was brilliant.
Well, tonight we're going to be talking about architecture and morality, and we're going to be looking at it in depth, about how it came about, you know, what was, I mean, this was your third album, and I suppose I want to know what changed, really, you know, from the first two. I just wrote here as my notes that the movies around at the time were Superman 2, Raiders of the Lost Ark, On Golden Pond. Any of them, any influences?
Not musically. Although I have to say, I mean, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You can see that.
Classic movie. I mean, absolutely brilliant. But I mean, a lot of people talk about the third album as being the difficult one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, we made our first two albums were released about 8 months apart from each other. We got two albums out in 1980 because we just had so many ideas. And I think after the success of Enola Gay, you know, the first album was all the songs we'd written as kids, like round at Paul's mum's house when we were sort of 16 to 19. And then we did I mean, we're 45 years old and 2 days now, I think, our customer Lives in the Dark. But we, you know, what started as a mad idea with us just doing crazy sounds in his mum's back room on a Saturday, we'd done two albums. The first one had gone gold. Messages was a hit.
Yeah, that was the first single I bought.
Actually. You told me that just
first single I owned.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And then obviously Enola Gay, which is so. I think by this stage we were feeling pretty confident that we, you know, we weren't going to get dropped by the record company, which we assumed would happen because nobody would buy the records. Yeah. And it was just, we did what we wanted. And people seemed to buy it. It was amazing. It was bonkers. It wasn't supposed to happen. But so, yeah, we just went, right, okay, well, we've done the kind of garage synth-pop and we've done the kind of gothic-y thing, and now we're going to do the Mellotron with Scottish military bagpipes and drums sound.
And it's a natural progression.
And why not? Exactly. You know, I mean, it was working in my head. I don't know where my head was at the time. Yeah. I wasn't on drugs. But it was... off we went and started doing this... Again, completely different sounding record. And who knew it was going to be even bigger than the other two?
So with the first single, I read or maybe heard in an interview that you wrote it when you were 16, is that right?
Electricity off the first album. Yeah. I mean, we were... I think Paul was either 15 or nearly 16. I mean, we had this kind of symbiotic relationship. I bought the German imports.
Yes.
And then I went round to his house because he'd made a stereo and I had a rubbish mono, my mother's mono record player. Yeah. So I would go round to his house and we would listen to music, and then we had this crazy idea that we might like to kind of make music.
Yeah.
But all we had was my upside down left-handed bass guitar, and Paul just had his auntie's radios and started ripping the guts out of them and making noises on the circuits, and that's how we started.
Amazing. And Electricity was mixed by Martin Hannah, is that right?
Yeah. Because
sorry, this is all pre-architecture. Yeah, but we know that. So.
We'd played the factory for our second ever gig.
Yeah.
And we'd met Tony. We cheekily thought, well, try and get on Granada Reports. We'll send him a cassette. And we didn't know what went on in the background. We subsequently heard about this story about his wife and the bag of rejects in the car, and she'd got in and pulled it out and went, "Well, customer maneuvers in the dark. Are you taking all this to the tip?" And he went, "Yeah, rubbish. The hairy buggers from Wirral banging on about electrical nonsense. They're not a real band. Not my cup of tea." She played it. He agreed to sign us. And then 7 days later, we were no longer a pair of hairy buggers from the Wirral banging on about electricity. We were the future of pop, according to Tony Wilson. Yeah. He could change his mind very quickly, could our Tony? And I think, you've probably heard the story. I think we used the words beginning with F and said, "We're not effing pop. We're experimental. But if you want to make a record, we'll make a record." And then it was, years later, Peter Saville told me that we were the only one on Factory that followed the blueprint, which was sign a local band, make a record, sell them on, use the money, develop another band. And Peter just said, "Everybody bloody stayed after you went. Yeah. So, it was a remarkable journey through the first 18 months to, doing a one-off gig and then having our first hit single with Messages within, 15, 16 months.
Amazing. Top of the Pops and all that.
Yeah, that was another weird one. How many times did you do Top of the Pops?
I lost count.
It was the 90s, wasn't it? You were all off your faces. I know. Yeah,
a handful, for sure.
Yeah, because I just remember. I don't know if you. What was your first experience? I was just like, "Oh wow, amazing! Top of the Pops! I can't believe it!" Then you go, the stage is tiny and the audience are a bit will be mown down and I'm bored because I've been here for 9 hours to do 3 minutes work. It's a weird one, isn't it?
I think we did then as our first Top of the Pops appearance, and I upset everyone by shaving my head, which was
your iconic mop.
My mop top.
Did your mother think about that?
She's horrified. She just likes me anyway.
She loves you regardless of your hair. Fair enough.
She's got to be nice to your mum, right? So, they'll be nice to you back. Anyway,
we digress.
Shall we hear track one?
Yeah, let's play some music.
Does anyone know what track one's called?
New Stone Age. Somebody
very good. I wanted to give a bit of audience participation, you see that. So let's listen to that.
Pointy bass drum, you said.
I know that my notes. I know what it means. I mean, it's
very really, clicky, very clicky, hard,
great bass drum sound.
And you said under your breath, Eno guitar.
Yeah.
Scratch guitar, ostrich guitar. Used to go.
That's how I like to play guitar as well.
It's the only way I can play guitar. In fact, when I play it live, the guitar is tuned to an open E, and it's just capoed on F, and I just bar it onto A. It's just A, and it's just like that. It's idiot-proof guitar play. Even I can do it.
the synths in that initial bit is to me like the architecture. It was kind of like maybe a slanted building or something. It sounds like
they were they were designed to kind of howl. It's supposed to be like screaming, howling synths, and I think they were just. There's a track on the new album called GEM where I've done the same thing where. I used to build a synth melody by just playing occasional notes and then overdubbing and doing other notes, just seeing what happens. It's like, scream, that one, this one. I'll re-record that. And just random notes till I built a pattern that I liked.
As opposed to being like consciously discordant. Yeah,
I was just because the, I mean, this track kind of doesn't sound like any other track on
no,
the album.
No,
it's much
amazing.
More aggressive.
Yeah.
And then it calms down. But this was me just left on my own in the studio one night, and I came up with this.
Did you sing? Were you on your own when you did the singing then as well, or did you finish it?
Yeah, a lot of this album was actually recorded in our studio, and then we took it down to the Manor and we overdubbed.
Yeah,
because we had a 16 track, and if you put it on a 24 track, you got space in between. You could get 8 extra channels to do overdubs and things.
Yeah.
This was my original demo, because actually I was in such a hurry to get this idea down. The bass drum was on another track which wasn't working. Right. So I just muted all the channels and put them into record, started playing with this bass drum. And then that's why the song mutates at the end of the song. It turns into the other song that was already on the tape, and these other tracks just start opening up, and it kind of, and it's in a different key, and it's got this kind of churning kind of, ooh, where's that going to? But it was just, I was just in a hurry. I used to do most of my vocals in the control room with an SM58, and then it was hard if we changed the song to take out them, because there's so much noise.
Siblings.
So much noise. I mean, the song on the album Joan of Arc, there's a white noise that's going really loud, and it was just, it was really hard to get that out. We actually had to put it back in out of phase to try and get it off my mic. It worked. But it was a kind of kick-ass first song to start with anyway. Yeah.
But was there a reason why that was the opener then? Was it because of that?
I think it's just making a statement, really. Yeah. You know, I think there was nowhere else to put it. I think we had to start with it, and then we could go on a different journey, you know? That's the way it seemed to me at the time anyway.
And then we've got here that it's kind of the vocals are quite scary.
Do you know what's funny is that this is actually a love song. I mean, I do things all the wrong way around. You know, it's like I write a happy song about dropping atom bombs, and I write a scary song about being in love. I mean, I was dating somebody who went to Bristol University and was staying in a female-only halls of residence. So I had to sneak into. Every time I went to loo, she said, "Put the seat down afterwards. Make sure people will know you're here." And this is the room, this is the wall. She had a single bed, it was bloody freezing. And my arse was always on the stone wall. That's what that refers to. This is the room, this is the body I've been hoping for. It's about me being in bed with her with my bum freezing on the wall because we were in a single bed. You don't want to know this, do you? I've blown the whole... You're thinking, I thought that was about something totally more interesting than that.
The mystique.
I've blown the mystique now.
Was everything... you know, taken from your studio and then you went to the Manor. With every track went through that process?
I think most of them were.
Or should we carry on talking about arses?
Which... No, it's all right. We'll move swiftly along, please. I think most of them were, as I recall, which was good because we had the basis already recorded. Because after that, when we started, when we lost our studio, and we'd go into a studio and do everything from scratch. We did a lot from scratch on organisation, and I had demo. I thought I was the only one that called things demo-itis, but apparently,
because
Will Sargent mentions it in his biography. Like, everybody has demo-itis.
Yeah,
like the final recording doesn't sound like the demo, and you can't stand it. It takes months to like the final recording. So taking the multitracks was great.
Yeah. Okay, so can we listen to track number 2, She's Leaving, please?
She pretends.
I do love this song.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's only a song about the time.
It It was supposed to be the fourth single.
I was going
to
say,
it should have been, and it would have been a big hit. There was a lead singer in this band at the time, who said to the record company, "You're not going to prostitute our art by releasing four singles." I could fucking kill him. It was released in Benelux, and it wasn't a hit. We love playing this song live. Stuart, our drummer, loves playing this. This is his favourite song.
It's so emotional, you know. Yeah. I mean, it should
Stuart, who was born on the same day as you, the same year.
Right, yes, that's right.
30th of May, 67. Yeah. Yeah, there you go, shared with him. But
Scorpio Rising.
Yeah, well, you know all that stuff. I love that song. And of course, at the end, because I'm playing the bass live,
yeah.
and I'm known to hit the wrong note, and it's exaggerated by the fact that Martin always hits the right note on the bass synth. But at the end of the song, when I'm actually playing a split octave and just strumming my bass, yeah. And Martin goes in for what we call the Queen Mary, where he just drops down the off and just goes, there's this massive synth bass note that flaps your trousers live. It's great, it's proper sub. And so I've gone up and I'm going ding a ling a ling a ling, and he's going. Because Martin always does the cool thing. Martin, it was always cool.
Was it the Rickenbacker or Precision?
It was. What was I? I was playing the Precision. I briefly played a Rickenbacker copy when my Wilson Rapier was nicked.
So it was very early. Was it before this album that mostly you were playing it? Or?
The Wilson Rapier was played on some of the early recordings, this was my left-handed bass where I learned to play upside down. The first time we played a Factory Records night at Acklam Hall in London, somebody nicked my bass. Uh-huh. There was rumours it was hooky, but I don't believe it. I couldn't go back to playing the right way up because I'd been playing the wrong way for 4 years. So I started buying right-handed guitars. Had a Rickenbacker copy, which I hate. Always wanted a Rickenbacker because Chris Squire out of Yes. But mine sounded rubbish. Then I got my Fender Jazz, and that was it. The Fender Jazz was then on Messages, Souvenir, Joan of Arc, Enola Gay. And I've still got that bass.
Was this like the album where you started to really understand and enjoy recording studios? You know, and, I mean, you know, just saying when we were chatting just then while the music was playing that it was a synth bass and a bass. Yeah. You know, I mean, where do you learn that kind of stuff?
The thing was, there's three processes. There's writing, recording, and performing live.
Yeah.
I like the first one and the last one. The recording and mixing was traumatic for me. Yeah. I just
on every album.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, recently because the Pro Tools demos become the final mix, it's not as scary. Mm-hmm. But no, I was just traumatized. I mean, listen. The first time I heard Bauhaus Staircase when the video was being made, I phoned up Paul and I went, "It sounds terrible on my small speakers. It's shocking. We need to remix it. There's too much sub bass and not enough 250k, and 250 hertz."
Yeah.
And he went, "No, it sounds fine." I lost it. I did my usual. I lost the plot and I went back to France, and I insisted that we rework it and we redid it, and it sounded much better to me. And then 4 days later, I phoned up and I went, "No, the new one's shit. I'd lost the plot. Sorry, mate. Let's go back to the original version." And Paul was like, "I knew you were going to do that."
It's
knowing that the version you finish and abandon is going to be the one that everybody hears forevermore after.
Yeah.
It terrifies me. It really does.
Shall we move on to a track that was a single?
Let's do that.
And this is track 3, Souvenir.
Thank you.
hated it at the time. It's well documented. Paul hated Enola Gay, thought it was cheesy pop, and I thought this was cheesy. I tried and tried and tried to toughen this song up.
Right.
I tried a fuzzy bass guitar, this, and in the end, all I could do was just go. I felt like I was playing a country western song. Boom, 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 da dum, da dum, da. I was just like, oh god, that's not a punk. That's not a punk bass line. That's not a cool bass line. But of course, after about 6 months, I realised it's actually whole great big slice of melancholy beauty, and it's a great song.
And when this video was being shown everywhere, you know.
Well, yes, of course. Peter Saville decided he was more than a sleeve designer. He was going to be, he was going to be Fellini and direct a video. Of course, ever since we made this video, because of course Paul is standing there on the bridge at Stowe School, and I'm driving around Blenheim Park. He said it looked like Tatton Park.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
very similar. And then, of course, I drive up and say, hey, baby, get in the car. And we drive off into the sunset. And for decades after, people just assumed that we were a gay couple. When we reformed in Smethurst, I'm so glad they're back together. they're straight. And this guy went, they are? I think this is probably where it started. But it's a beautiful song.
Yeah, pop perfection.
It really is. It really is. And you know, it was all made out of Dave Hughes, who used to be in our band before Martin joined.
Yeah.
He came in with these recordings of a choir that he'd been recording, and he just said, Paul, can we make tape loops out of this? And literally old-fashioned, you know, pencils around the room, putting them onto the multitrack. And then Paul started using the multitrack as a writing tool, just pushing up the different chords. And he wrote this,
So the multitrack being the 24...
This was track, 16 tape. Tracks, 16 the 16 track, track multi-track, 16 yeah. Track. And it was, and it was just he. That's where it came from. It just came from these choir recordings. Because they were going around pencils and sort of like whoeing, and that's what gives it that kind of unearthly feel. It's like, wow, because they weren't completely staying in pitch.
It's making me think of 10cc now.
Yeah, except that was all them recording themselves over and over again.
But it's a sort of similar and as interesting a process.
I mean, it's because there was only two of us in the band, we learnt to use the technology. And I said I don't like recording. I didn't like making the final record. I loved writing the songs, and we wrote them onto tape because there was nobody else in the studio.
So you're writing in the studio.
Yeah, we were writing in the studio.
It's the mixing you don't like.
Yeah, it was just the final to the final version. Yeah. It's just me. I'm a worrier.
I get that, though. I get that. I mean, I love, you know, I love playing live. I love writing. You know, something from there's nothing for 1 second, and then...
Yeah.
And then something that just becomes something else, and you know, becomes something. Actually, I really love that too, and I definitely do find the mixing process the hardest.
I think when you're writing something and you're demoing it,
you're
not hearing what you're actually doing. You're bringing a lot of imaginary to it. You know, going, this is going to be like this. Because I listen to the we're releasing on the Bauhaus Staircase album. Yeah. We're releasing a CD of demos.
Yeah.
And I went back to the early recordings, and I went, particularly actually the title track Bauhaus Staircase. I thought this was absolutely kicking ass.
Yeah.
And my first version of it is pathetic. Yeah. I really was listening to this with rose-coloured ears, wasn't I? So, but it's quite interesting to hear where songs came from to where they ended up.
Yeah, because when you're writing it at the very beginning, you know, you can hear all this other stuff that might end up being on it. And
you can imagine anything.
When it's finished, it's going to be amazing. Yeah. Okay.
That's great.
We should listen to Sealand next, because that's the last track on side one.
Long song. Yeah, I mean, we'd done Stanlow on the previous album, which is on one side of the Wirral Peninsula. Sealand is on the... I was just looking for nice-sounding geographical locations.
The end section, I don't know whether we'll get to the end section, but there's that whole banging thing that's going on.
I mean, it was... It really was very, very ambient. It didn't... I think we had no idea where we were going, but we just were enjoying the journey, and we just decided we didn't need to kind of pop it up or add loads of stuff to it.
More industrial than anything.
Yeah, it was working as it did, but We'll go and have a pint and they can listen to 7 minutes of Sealand. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing a bit of it. Oh, all right, okay, can we, all listen, right, can we listen to Sealand?
We just literally, I had this idea that I want to write something called Sealand. Mm-hmm. And started with a harmonica, and we sort of like do sort of sea shanty thing. Mm-hmm. And then we just put a drum machine going, just going, tick, 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 and sort of boom, boom. It was hand played, like bam, bam. No idea why there's two beats missing, but we just left them out. We never bothered to go back. So it's kind of, it's got this moment, just kind of goes, oh, stops. But it's, I think a lot of people, when they first heard it, was like, how did they write Enola Gay and Souvenir and then this? And it took some adjusting to it, but I think it's just, I mean, even they're listening to it, you know, you just pause. This is it's like mindfulness music before the phrase was coined. Yeah. You just have to go with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going with that.
Yeah, yeah. Good, good.
Relax. I mean, there's so much space, like created for that song to sort of like, you know, to breathe and to take you wherever you want to go. You know,
you're right. It's empty. I mean, there's nothing going on in there. It really is just standing, looking out to sea with the odd thing coming into view and out of view, and it's just. I got no idea how we did it. It was completely alien to us, but we were prepared to try anything because we just believed. We believed that we could do anything and we'd get away with it, that people would like it. So, well, if we like it, people seem to like what we do. So this is crazy. But the record company didn't hear this album until we delivered it.
Right, right.
They never sent anybody to come listen to us. They never told us what to do. They just...
They believed in us.
I mean, I can't believe that the first album we did, they gave three 19-year-old kids 30 grand and let us build our own studio and just deliver an album. Madness.
But how did the sleeve come about? You know, the sleeve for
Mr. Saville. The name, of course, came about because of Martha Ladley.
I've got records by her, actually.
Very creative lady,
and your former label mates New Order, and Tony Wilson would say that Blue Monday lost money because of the cutout in the sleeve.
You have a cutout of the sleeve
mm-hmm. on this, and
the first album had, of course, all the lozenges. It was a thing called. Did you ever have any cutouts on your sleeves or anything?
No, never gone that way.
So you never heard those two wonderful words, packaging deduction.
Oh, yeah, I have heard of that. Yeah, but I can't remember what...
Anything you wanted to do that was out of the normal, the record company took money off you. Oh, we've had to do terribly strange things, so we're going to reduce your royalty because of packaging deductions. And So
basically Peter Saville's to blame.
Peter stitched us up completely. Yeah. He owes me money, basically. I should have a word, actually.
Were you ever involved in any of Martha's records?
No. I didn't. I thought Martha was an amazing, amazing woman.
Yeah.
Of course, the Muffins were, you know, Martha and the Muffins, they were on Dindis with us.
Yes.
And they had the first hit with Echo Beach. Yeah. Lovely people, great band.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking there's two Marthas in the band?
That's correct. Yeah, that was the trick.
Yeah,
there was two Marthas. Yeah. There was the one who sang and the one who played
Martha
the keyboards.
Martha Ladley played keyboards.
Yeah. So, Martha said, "I've got this title that I got from a book, and I just turned the words around." He said, "Yeah, I think you should have it because you'd." And so, I mean, it was just. It appealed to the pretentious 22-year-old McCluskey.
Yeah.
And we went in the studio, and of course the title track, which you'll hear, was just made up. But I tell you, it is quite weird sitting here listening to your own music and not performing it.
Yeah.
It's just, no, Andrew, you can't do your weird dance, you can't sing, you've just got to sit and listen. It is quite a surreal experience,
actually. Am I right to suggest that, I've definitely heard the story, that you've knocked out your bandmate with your bass guitar?
No.
Is that not true?
That's not true.
Overdancing?
There've been a couple of times when I wanted to knock him out with my guitar. As Paul says, you know, I have now spent 45 years overcompensating for his static performance.
Oh, that's brilliant.
The dancing thing came from not wanting to be like Kraftwerk, not wanting to...
This is electronic, but we're not
trying to be robots. It is emotional. You can dance to it, and it's got feelings. We're not trying to be bloody robots.
Yeah, it's certainly emotional. I mean,
thank you.
The opener of side two is Joan of Arc.
Yes, one of two Joan of Arcs.
One of two Joan of Arcs. Did you only write two?
Two's more than normally you get. I mean, I was so determined. I was on a mission to write a song about Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
And I wrote the waltz one first, and I thought it was not working. And interestingly enough, actually, when we did the Souvenir 40th anniversary, Paul found the demo, and we released it. Yeah. And it was crap. And now I know why I wrote the other Joan of Arc, because the waltz Joan of Arc, the demo was like, oh my God, what planet was I on with that bass line? And it was actually Malcolm. We were packing up to go down to the Manor studio, and Malcolm, our drummer, said, are we going to do both Joan of Arcs? I said, no, I've got this new one now. He went, no, that... He literally said to me, let me play drums on it, it'll be a hit. So he did, and it was. Can I say? You know? So... But yeah, I was determined. Now, we have a surprise for me with Joan of Arc.
I know.
Because somebody has Top of the Pops video that I don't remember. And it's not me.
So you didn't actually do a video for this one, then?
No, we didn't do a video because Souvenir was... The European market is much slower. So Souvenir was still in the charts, but we needed something to kind of keep the flow going in the UK, so we released this.
Yeah.
But the record company, being tight, just went, well, if the rest of the world aren't going to see, we're not going to make a video. So I remember doing Joan of Arc. I think I had a yellow jumper and a cravat on. But there must have been a time when we weren't available.
Yeah.
And either I have forgotten or chosen to forget that somebody else performed it for us.
So, shall we look at the video that we're talking about? And it's by Legs & Co.
Does anybody remember this? I don't. You, yeah? No? Well, let's see it. Who are listening to the podcast, you don't know what you've just missed visually. But that was, six ladies dressed in blue and dancing, and it's
a pointy hat.
Has anybody seen that before?
No.
Are you sure that somebody didn't just commission that, especially for this particular podcast? Was it even, I can't even tell it was Legs & Co, because they're all looking... They're there, yeah. They're wearing clothes, yeah, they're true. Well, yeah, but that was... But I was struck there at the end, though, about how I'd gone up the register and I was singing in that kind of McCluskey kind of I really mean it. And it's like, you're a 22-year-old atheist singing about a French saint and you still sound like you care.
What did you, you know, what did you make of the film, the the Carl Theodore Dyer film? Have you seen it? Or were you just, what's the story about writing Joan of Arc songs?
Do you know one of the weird things is, and I don't know if you find this, if you get a bee in your bonnet about wanting to write about a subject, and you get, I get like a geek, I research it and get immersed in, like I'm writing a thesis. By the time I've written it, recorded it, mixed it and performed it, it's kind of cathartic, it's kind of done.
Yeah.
So actually, after all this was done, I don't want to see any Joan of Arc films. I did also have the other thing where, you know, it's kind of like a cliche, like they used to, like men who thought they were reincarnated always thought they were Napoleon or Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
All women who think they're reincarnated are either Cleopatra or, as I discovered, Joan of Arc. I got literally hundreds of letters from all over the world. Thank you for writing a song about me.
Wow.
It was like, oh, I've opened a can of worms here, haven't I? So, yeah, so that was a very, very strange experience. But, no, I mean, two songs about Joan of Arc, I was done.
Yeah.
I didn't need to learn any more about her or see any films.
A friend of mine, Julia Holter, she did a sort of, you know, a new score for, because it's a silent movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like one of the... It's one of the best things I've ever seen, really. You know, it was at the Barbican and the massive screen, Joan of Arc. I mean, horrifying, you know, but with this brand new kind of like interest in music as a new score. I just wondered like whether you'd...
You've piqued my interest now. Maybe there's enough time has passed I should go and...
I'm sure that like musicians kind of watch stuff and sort of like think to themselves, oh, I'm going to write an imaginary score for this. I do. But you know, it's sort of like one of my favourite films, I think. I'll turn the sound down and sort of like try and, you know, write something. And I just wondered whether that was how it started or...
I've never thought about writing a soundtrack to something. I've said, oh, God, I would like to put something... I've never been inspired that way. That's interesting that you've thought that.
And Rocky, you know, being one of my favourite films and you really? Know, Star Wars.
Star Wars, I guess. I've never had you down as a boxer, to be honest, Tim. I've never thought about that, to be honest. But you're going to have to give me all the details on this film. You've piqued my interest. I might have to go and check it out.
Yeah, she's really great anyway. But that was a really good experience.
Just before we move off that song, because that was a song, that was another one where I was in the studio on my own and I just, you know, that was the second one I wrote. The waltz one was the first one. And I just laid down.
And they were both singles, right?
They were both singles. That was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was desperately trying to get the record company to release them under the same name. I just thought, this is really going to... You know, I'm going to change the world by screwing with people's heads, releasing two different songs under the same name. I don't know what... Pretentious little bugger. But I just... Anyway, I mean, there was an argument backwards and forwards there for weeks and weeks about, you know, no, it's going to be the same. Now, Andy, they won't buy it. They won't buy it. No, it's going to be the same name. I finally relented, which was probably the right thing. But all of that is... That's all me. That is, all of the little choral voices. That's all me layered and layered. And then I played the Glockenspiel, using the notes in the key of just D major, just going bing 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 bing. I just created this bed track of this kind of ambient swirl, and then I sang into it and just started building the track up, and that was just. I knew this one worked.
Yeah.
I really knew this one worked as soon as I'd written it. And I think it was, if I can remember rightly, was it written on the night of the something like the 550th anniversary of the death of Joan of Arc.
Right.
So,
right.
But then we went down to the Manor Studios.
Yeah.
And Malcolm persuaded us to have another go at the other Joan of Arc, which ended up being the bigger hit.
So Malcolm seems like a real key figure. You've mentioned him a lot, you know.
Yeah, Malcolm had a way of playing drums that was. I mean, even though we kind of straitjacketed him, he hated us because we were so determined that we didn't want a rock and roll kit with all the spill and the overheads.
Sure.
First of all, he had cymbals banned.
Yeah.
Then we made him play the bass drum on its own.
Yeah.
Then the snare drum on its own.
Yeah.
And the hi-hat on its own. Because we didn't want this kind of messy kind of slushy drum sound.
Is that like a kind of Martin Hannett kind of
Yeah. So poor Malcolm's job was, you know, it was horrible. But yeah, he actually played the big, it was a military bass drum. It's not his bass drum from his kit. It was a boom, cha, cha, boom, rat-a-tat-a-tat-a, boom. And we just let him go. He just did all the fills, and then he came in with this floor tom at the end, just hammering it away. And then when you see him play it live, and Stuart had to do this, it was incredible to see it swapping hands and having to do the snare drum fills and the tom, keeping it rolling. It's just like this crossing over his hands. It was like it was amazing. I mean, you know, Paul and I started the band and wrote most of the songs, but Martin and Malcolm need to get credit for the things they added to it that made certain things sound better than we would have done it without them.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
So, should we hear the other?
So the next up's
The Maid of Orleans.
Another Joan of Arc, Maid of Orleans.
It was too short. When we recorded it, it was too short, so we need to extend it. We can't extend the ending, so...
Did you do 12-inch of it?
Let's just... No,
is it no.
We just put a load of noise on the front of it just to kind of extend it. And we were just playing things into the heat, because we didn't have amplifiers or fuzz boxes. We were just playing mellotrons and organs into the Helios desk at the man and just turning everything up so the desk distorted. Yeah. So it's going...
That's quite a different distortion than digital distortion.
Yeah, no,
it?
I mean it was valves.
Yeah,
going frying themselves. It was great.
I love that.
That was the first video we ever made where I thought, oh, we've actually made a really good video, finally. It was, I mean, Julia Tobin actually was a Shakespeare actress. She went on to be in, what was the TV series she was in? She was in TV series as well. But, it was great because Paul and I didn't have to act. It was just, I just had to sing. And we were blessed with the snow.
Everyone looks good. It's, medieval. And,
well, the funny thing is
and jumpers, great jumpers.
Oh,
as well.
My Andy Williams Christmas special jumper.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, chess is involved.
Chess players involved. Snow, arrows. Yeah. He just whispered to me, "I'm going to have to write a song because I want to make a video on horseback in armor." So you heard it here first.
Yeah, that's,
next Tim Burgess song.
Yeah, that's it's a life goal.
Why have you waited so long?
I don't know. I think it's. I don't know. That's a good point, because I must have seen that video so often. I just knew that it had already been done so well.
You should do your own thing.
I'd do a gallop, I think.
A gallop? Oh, really? Okay. Have you ever ridden a horse?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
All right.
Blackpool Beach.
That was a donkey, surely. Yeah. Let's move swiftly along. Right?
Yeah, so what was the process of this song? How did it come about?
Well, I said this was the first one I wrote. Yeah. This was the one, I can remember sitting down. I think I was using one of our kind of organs that that had drum machines in it, and so I think I had a waltz on the drum machine of the organ, just boom,
nice.
And I don't know why I chose waltz, but.
Song.
I guess because we hadn't done one as a waltz, because we wanted to do something different.
Breaks the album up really well,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
You know.
So, and I had the melody, I had the vocal line, but the original bass line, instead of just being do do do, it was do 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 do, and it was like, it was crap. It was so. go and find the demo. You won't know how we made this wonderful song, because it was just... we salvaged it from the wreck that my demo was. I didn't have demoitis on this one. This was much better.
The strings, would that be like a ARP or a Selena?
No, it's a Mellotron. Okay. There's a Mellotron choir.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the main melody is actually supposed to be a violin.
On the Mellotron.
Yeah, but it sounds kind of more like a bagpipe. It's got that really kind of pipey kind of... But I mean, it's
Mellotrons are so wonky anyway.
Oh,
aren't they?
They're great. They're wonderful. Yeah. We were trying to be the future, but we were using something that was, you know, 10... Yeah, it's about 15, 18 years old. And we bought a second-hand one. And I remember when we were in the manor, this thing wouldn't stop making a noise. It just go going... had this constant whine, and it didn't matter. We took the motor out, we put the motor in, we took the transformer out, we wrapped foil around it. We're trying to get rid of this one. So in the end, we phoned up Streatley Electronics, who made the Mellotron. We said, we've got a Mellotron and it won't stop whining. They went, is it a Mark One? We said, yes, it is. They went, design fault, sorry. That was it. That was we just play it loud and you won't hear the whine. So, but yeah, it would just...
So the Mark One, is that the small one or the big one?
No, it's just the first one they made. And, right. Have you ever used one?
We have had the small one, which is, about that big. And,
yeah,
and,
but it had the tapes in it.
Yeah, or
still
tapes.
You had to open it up and get the tapes, yeah.
We actually have George Harrison's Mellotron at the Charleston studio.
Oh, you just happen to have George. Yeah. Well, yeah. Is it the one that they did Strawberry Fields on?
No, that was done on a very small one. We got a big one, and it's endless amount of fun, you know, with the kind of... Dinka dinka ding dinka ding ding dinka dinka ding ding. Yeah. We would do that after every song for a whole album.
I just think that they're so Heath Robinson. You know, they have come up with the idea of, like, you know, there's a long but metal bar with a flywheel, and when you press a key, it presses the tape onto the metal bar that drags it over a tape head, and it only lasts, what is it? 10, 11
seconds. It's like a sample.
It's original sample.
Yeah.
And then when it gets to the end, it just stops.
Yeah.
Because the tape runs out, and then you have to let it go, and a spring goes and pulls it back again.
Yeah.
And because this song, all the chords were held so long, we had to, like, Paul would hold the chord, and then it would run out.
Yeah.
Then you have to go back in, wind back sort of 8, 9 seconds, and then drop back in again, and hope there wasn't a big clunk when because the Mellotron itself wouldn't play for more than 10 seconds before the tapes ran out.
I love that though, because, you know,
you like the quirkiness, don't you?
I do, because I like things that sound a little bit odd, you know. And I suppose, like, when you've just got, you know, something that you can just buy, you know, and a digital version, it doesn't have that kind of, like, thing that you have to, you have to have all, you know, it's time management, isn't it? Because, you know, you're pressing the chord and the tape's running and. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just you messing with tape, you know, and it's just the best thing, really.
Yeah. No, and I mean, because each note was sampled and, you know, the speed was a bit off. And, yeah, as you say, it had that wobbly thing and that it was supposed to be a choir, but it wasn't. It was supposed to be a flute, but it wasn't. So it had this kind of slightly unreal sound, because the Mellotron, for those who, you know, and it's like, it's the flute on Strawberry Fields and it's kind of real but not real. I mean, just for us, it was just, we took one on tour.
Yeah, we did actually. Yeah.
Did you survive? Because we had a couple of really bad problems where the power went down.
Yeah.
And Paul was, like, turning the pitch wheel, trying to go, it won't stay in tune, it's going flat, I can't get to the notes.
I mean, it happens in Europe, you know. It happens with that Hammond organ quite a lot in Europe as
really?
Well. Yeah, we just end up sort of like, I don't know. It's like,
fortunately, we never. Going. What, do you have an old B3 or something? Sorry, we're getting geeky now, aren't we?
I mean, we've had to do a lot of our Hammond organ sort of based songs on the piano. So the only one I know on the piano isn't really kind of the same.
No.
But
have you gone digital now? Or do you still use the originals?
Well, obviously in the recording studio. But I was just thinking about, you know, when we were recording the Mellotron, just like yourself, you know, and running out of time on the actual chord. And Yeah, I've geeked out so much now that I don't know what I'm saying. But, okay. But that's okay.
But I mean, because we have the thing now where people say, have you still got the original and do you still use? Because, yeah, we've got Mellotron on this album and Roland SH-1s and SH-09s. Yeah. And everybody's like, oh, you're still using the originals? Like, no, we're using the soft synth plugins. Like,
yeah.
Traitors, sacrilege, yeah. Why are you not authentic anymore? It's
yeah.
like...
yeah.
Because you can't MIDI these things, and yeah. and you have to remember what you played. And
you can mix it up, though, can't you? You can use a little bit of both.
Yeah.
No.
Paul and I are completely in the box.
Yeah.
And we have twinned Pro Tools systems, so we can. They'll be editing all of this out for the podcast, won't they?
No. We
have twinned Pro Tools systems, so that I can send him. He's got all the same plugins, all the same keyboards, and so we don't have to bounce things down to audio. I think yeah. so. It's just. But yeah, it's,
don't use piano or anything, or digital piano. Too.
Don't really use much piano, to be honest. But
all in the box.
All in the box. Okay.
Should we go to the next track?
Quickly, yeah. Let's get there
okay.
now.
Okay.
So let's what not is go the next geeky track? On this?
Is it architecture?
Oh come on! You bought the album, don't you know what's next?
Architecture and morality.
Yeah. Let's play it.
Let's play
it. This is the one. That we wrote in the studio, we were just throwing everything onto tape, just all sorts of weird noises and smashing rocks in the stone room at and yeah, we had lots of fun. So much fun this time. The dilemma is I don't remember how we made most of those sounds.
Yeah,
we were
course,
just
yeah.
doing it at the time and throwing it onto tape and just feeling. I mean, the great thing about that was there was no rules. I didn't need to sing. There was no chorus. There didn't have to have a melody. Mm-hmm. Imagine if we'd given that to the record company and said we wanted that to be the first single.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting, wouldn't it? But, we were just throwing it onto tape. I mean, just feeling it. You know, and that's the great thing. Right, okay, we've done enough of that sound. Let's have another sound. What do we got? I don't know. That'll do. Yeah, throw that on. Let's see what happens.
Yeah,
just
like
sculpt.
A new sound at every eight bars or something.
Yeah,
like
we
that.
Were just sculpting it. And it was, architectural morality.
Did you always know that it was going to be an instrumental?
Yeah, I think so, because it was written in the studio. And it was literally, that was the last thing we did for the album.
Right.
And... it was a case of, you know, it was just nice because I didn't have to write any words or think of a melody.
It's
was just
pressure, like, right?
Yeah, it didn't have to conform to any rules. So off it went on its own little journey. And I mean, again, that's testament to the fact that we had confidence in ourselves. You know, we were just, no, we are going to do this. This is me. I mean, you know, I think this was probably the track where the record company made the famous quote, do you guys want to be Stockhausen or ABBA?
Right, yeah.
And we were like, can't we be both?
Well, of course,
you know?
Of course.
It's because they just like, how do you write Souvenir and then that? It's like, because we do.
Well, yeah. I mean, and how do you have a song before, you know, in a 3/4 time? You know, because I suppose you have the idea that you're making an album and that there needs to be variety and you've already, you know, in your pocket... got some killer hit singles, so you know, you need a song called Architecture and Morality. and does this sum up Architecture and Morality for you as a phrase?
I tell you what, I think that the pressure was taken off us because Souvenir had been recorded separately from the album
and was already released.
So we had a hit in the bag. Yeah. So I think we felt like, okay, well, the pressure was... I mean, Georgia was considered as a single as well at one point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously She's Leaving should have been a single, stupid boy here wouldn't let it be released. It, you know, it's so hard to think back now. I mean, this is 42. I mean, I'm 64 now. This is 42 years ago. I'm trying to remember who I was, what I was thinking, how we, the dynamic between us, you know, how we wrote things, how we thought and interacted, because it's been such a long journey. We've all changed. And what one thing I realized as well 3 years ago when we did the 40th anniversary album, my memory is shocking. I had all these like memories that turned out to be complete fiction.
Right.
I mean, I remember emailing Stephen Morris from New Order, yeah, saying, "Steve, I just want to check something with you. We played our first gig, didn't we, with you at Eric's in 1978?" He went, "I don't think so." And I went, no, we've been telling everybody that we played our first gig with Joy Division. Please tell me it's not some kind of Genesis myth we've created for ourselves that we did. Well, we did play with an artist that was JD. It was John Dowie, the comedian.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow, over the years, I'd turned that into Joy Division. And
he was on Factory, though, right?
He was on Factory, yeah, yeah. So there was a connection. Yeah. I mean, I can still sing some of his songs, you know. I won't sing them for you.
No.
Let's talk about music again, quickly.
Georgia.
Yeah.
You just mentioned it should have been a single.
Yeah, it was. What was interesting, and again, this was another one. It was very bouncy. Yeah. I mean, and it sounds like sequences, all played by hand. You know, Paul and I used to think we'd get arthritic fingers because we used to play everything. It was like, basically the bass lines, just like do 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 do. Oh, fucking hell! there was no sequences in the early days. It was all played by hand. Yeah, that's why the timing slides.
Again, I think that's. I prefer that.
Well, it was the only way we could do it. Mm-hmm. So that was how it was done.
Yeah, yeah.
The I wanted to write a song about Georgia because this is a Cold War song. This is why when you've seen us play it live, we've got images of Che Guevara and Stalin, and because it's about the Russian Georgia, not the American Georgia.
Yeah.
And you know, we will watch the morning star rising over home Georgia. The only thing it didn't have was it didn't have a chorus. Mm. I couldn't think of a chorus for us. I just had the verses. And so in typical fashion, we went, right, this is not a problem. This is not a problem. We've got whatever it is, 8 bars. We've got the chords. We've got everything in. We just need a focus. Right, turn the radio on. Let's just record a load of stuff off the radio onto quarter-inch tape. Then we're going to randomly chop it up and see what comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just chopped it all up and we span it in. Yeah. And I think there's some French in there. Maintenant les deux accusés, which the 12 accused, I guess. I don't know. It was just throw it. There we go. And you know what? We'd put it in the next chorus. Then if you do it twice, it's a chorus. Yeah, total random. Yeah, just chopped up tape. Just... we didn't care. We're fearless. It was brilliant. And then Mr. Humphreys sings his little twinkle, twinkle socks off at the end there with his lovely...
I've got here another massive pop song.
Mm.
I love the synth. And I must be obsessed with this song, but it says it's like electricity, you know, but, you know, an updated version of electricity.
I never thought about it like that.
And I said, so pop, so fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean... I think you can apply your description to electricity when we were talking backstage.
Well, actually, now you mention it, that kind of really kind of crazy kind of we were just talking about the Guardian journalist Dave Simpson, who's written for us and done some work for us as well, and written about us. I remember the first time I talked to him, he said, I remember walking into the Futurama gig in Leeds in 1979. He said... all I could hear was what sounded like the Magic Roundabout theme on acid. And it was you guys playing electricity. And I just, that's the best description I've ever heard of electricity, the Magic Roundabout theme on acid. And I could imagine to a bunch of people in rainy, I think it was snowing.
Right.
The floor was soaking wet because all the muddy, and it was horrible and steamy and wet and cold in there. And we were just going, did it. And it must have been bonkers.
Well, I'm going to suggest that this is an updated version of that.
You can have
Magic Roundabout on Acid.
You can have that suggestion.
1981 but style. Can we have a listen?
Go for it. So, how can this be true?
Fantastic.
Oh, no. You made a very good point to me when it was playing.
What did I say?
You said it seemed to be right at the end of the album to have something more up-tempo again, so it didn't just sort of slow down completely, that it got lifted again before the ending. And
I think lyrically as well, you know, it's like, look, what were the lyrics? Look where we are, or look what we've done.
Here we are again.
And it's kind of like, you know, we're here, it's towards the end, but kind of it's a lift and we're back.
Do you know what was a really poignant moment? I remember when we reformed and we played in 2007 and we played this album in 2007.
Right.
And this was the first one where kind of, you know, it wasn't just like Architecture Mountain Cinema. We came on and we did this, and it was, I really felt like, you know, because it was like, well, here we are again. You know, it was just like, it was a great way to kind of like reintroduce yourselves. Yeah. But that's a good point. That, I mean, again, intuitively, maybe we put it there because we felt like it needed a little lift up before it settled down again for the last track. But yeah, another thing I remember about that song, the snare drum and the bass drum were not played by Malcolm. They were programmed off the CR78 drum machine because you could play it yourself.
Oh, wow.
And it had a little like push button thing.
The brown box.
Yeah, a little square brown box with the and you could actually play individual instruments. It was one of the first programmable drum machines. And talking about arthritis, knuckle, middle finger, bang, da 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 da, playing that bass drum. It's like, we were in agony by the time we got these drums down. I don't know why we didn't get Malcolm to play them instead, you know. But
I can see people singing along with that one. It seems like it's a big favourite, non-single. You know, you need them, don't you? You know, the non-single favourite.
I mean, it's... I can kind of see why people like this album, listening to it now. It's been a long time since... Well, actually, the last time I listened to it all the way through was, you know, two and a half, three years ago, the listening party. So... But as I say, it is, you know, I was somebody else then.
Yeah.
You know, I was somebody else. I was a 22-year-old guy who was just being thrown into the music industry. And to be honest, more often than not, was not enjoying it.
Right.
I was struggling. I mean, you know, I hated the criticism from journalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about this. It just hurts. You get lacerated. You know, you've done the very best you can. You've put your heart and soul into it. And, you know, particularly back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a style of journalism that the NME were particularly good at, but also Sounds, where it was just, if they didn't like something, they'd almost find a journalist who hated an album to review it, so they could sort of carve it up jokingly. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, completely eviscerate it. And, you know, this album, because we'd changed, and people expected another Enola Gay.
Yeah.
And when we... Do you remember... what was it? Was it Round Table on a Friday night on Radio 1? And, you know, they play new songs.
Yeah.
And they played Joan of Arc. And John Peel was on there.
Right.
And because John Peel had been a big champion, he played Electricity, and he didn't like Joan of Arc. He didn't get it. He thought it was dreary and weird. And it's like, you know, where's all the energy gone? Where's the synth punk thing gone? And then they went, well, that's an interesting review we've had from the pod. Anyway, surprise, surprise, live on the telephone, we've got Andy McCluskey, and I've been listening to this going, oh, daggers in the heart, especially John Peel. And I remember John kind of jokingly went, no, I didn't mean to put the word S at the front. It's a hit. And it was just like, it was excruciating. You know, having somebody who effectively helped start your career. So, yeah. And this is something. Have you ever read of a book Walking the Dinosaur? Or Eating the Dinosaurs, a journalist, American journalist. There's a great, great thing he said. And I think he was interviewing the lead singer of Weezer, and he was talking about how people who love what you do suddenly can change to hating what you'd be really angry at you. And he explained it, and I thought this is the best explanation I've ever heard. You are having a conversation with yourself when you create something. You're trying to pull something out of yourself and sculpt it so that it's the best way of reflecting what you're trying to feel and think. And when you think you've got it right, it really resonates with you. Yeah. And then you release it. And other people come along and they go, oh my gosh, he's speaking my language. He's talking to me. I didn't know anybody else felt the same of me. They resonate completely because you're speaking their language.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you release isn't speaking their language. Mm-hmm. And they feel abandoned and angry with you. And I kind of get why people, you know, somebody who was a fan goes, what have you done? Why are you not talking to me anymore? Why have you changed your language? And that's why they get so angry with you. And I just thought, I'm so glad I read that. I was like, that is the best explanation I've ever heard for why people excited because you're talking to them, and then how they can get so angry and vitriolic with you because you're not speaking the language anymore. I thought it was a great, I got very deep and serious. but as you know, somebody who you must have done this in the early days when people say, why did you do that? Why did you write that? And you go, it just seemed like a good idea at the time. It doesn't make a good interview, does it? So you start kind of hypothesizing after the event, really trying to think of something interesting to say. But I've always tried to analyze the creative element and how people respond to it, and I'm 64 now. I think I might have got a handle on it.
Did you
ish? I might change my mind this week.
Yeah, well, you're allowed to. Did you get more political as time went on, when once you had your platform?
Well, because this was the other thing with the album, is it sold so many.
Yeah.
And one of the criticisms was, what do you say you want to change the world? How are you changing the world with songs about Sealand and Joan of Arc? And, you know, you need to be properly political. Right. So, of course, you know, I took this on board. I got really right. Okay. All right. I'm not messing around anymore now. That's when I got my shortwave radio out and started sampling and making Dazzle Ships. And it was a lot more political, and strangely enough, not only do people not want to buy it much, but all the critics who've been encouraging me to get political stepped aside and went, whoops, we're not having any part of that, you're on your own, mate.
Well, taking it back to Georgia, I think that you called it a chorus, you know, those radio waveforms, that made me feel really happy, you know.
Good.
Yeah,
because I'm glad to have been a service to you.
Yeah, because you know it's like it's instrumental, mm-hmm. and you know, and I think that lots of people would not call that a chorus, but mm-hmm. I would.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have several mantras in OMD, but one of them has always been, one mistake is a mistake, two mistakes is a chorus, three mistakes is jazz.
Well. I love that because, you know, I mean, I'm a very limited guitar player, but when I do play guitar, I make a lot of mistakes. And I just, the first time I make a mistake, I just do the same mistake again. And then.
There you go.
Again and again. And that becomes.
No, but that's getting jazzy then.
Yeah.
Jazz is a four-letter word. You shouldn't do that.
You're not into jazz.
Do you know what? I kind of like trad jazz.
Right.
But jazz, kind of that really kind of like seriously up its own arse jazz.
No.
It's just two things for me don't work. One is, it's like, get an instrument and try your hardest to make it make a sound that it's not supposed to.
Okay.
Like torture it. And the other thing is that I realize is like, the other thing about the, you know, modern jazz is like, think of a tune and then don't play any of the notes. Play all the other ones. Yeah. I don't get it. It doesn't talk to me. But that's because I'm not
pop,
a musician.
You're
I'm not a musician. I just make noise to make an end product. I don't care about being a good musician. I don't care about how many notes I can squeeze into a bar.
But I do like Coltrane on a Sunday. You know.
Whatever you do at home is fine. Just don't inflict it on anybody else, especially not me.
Beginning and the end. Glockenspiel. Electric guitars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you thought... Is this the one you thought might have been acoustic?
I thought... which is the one I thought might have had acoustic guitar on it? Maybe Georgia, I don't know, they've all been electric guitars, I believe.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this is actually me playing. This is the nearest I get to actually almost playing guitar properly. It's like ding, 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 ding. Because when we were on stage these days, Stuart plays it. The drummer comes down from his drum kit and plays the guitar because I can't anymore. But this, I mean, this just seemed to be the appropriate song to close the album.
Yeah,
on,
really. I mean, I'm obsessed with closers, so I was going to ask that. Mm-hmm. How did it, you know, I mean, we'll listen to it in a second, but how did it become that? And you just said it was obvious, really. But what makes a great closer?
I'm now trying to frantically go through all of our albums and just think about. We generally close on a slow song.
Yeah.
It just seems to be like, you know, you've been on this journey and then you kind of go, and come down. And then if you want to go around and start again, you can go up and go round again. Yeah. But it just always feels like you should finish on a slow one. And I mean, those of you who've heard the new album have heard Verushka. That, I mean, I still think A side and B side. So Verushka closes side A, and then there's another one that's just as beautiful called Healing that closes side B.
Yeah.
And
on Punishment of Luxury, what was the closer on that?
What's the last track on Punishment of Luxury? I can't remember. Pardon? Yeah. The view from here.
Yeah, gorgeous. Yeah, gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy George's favourite song by us.
Is it?
Did a cover version of it.
Oh, it's
which
great.
Was
it's
like,
great George,
wow,
yeah.
I was amazed about that. Yeah. So, I'm glad somebody else remembers what I've done.
Yeah. You're busy.
Memory man over there. Thanks, Ed. Again, View From Here just lets you down.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
I just think it's a nice way to kind of take a breath.
I asked Kevin Rowland about closers, and he said, I asked him what his favourite closer was, and he said that he's always disappointed by the last track of any album.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, what does he want then?
I don't know. I think there you go. That's a great, probably for the reason, probably just didn't want the album to end.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. Yeah, okay, yeah. I get that. Yeah. If you love an album, well, when it ends, you don't want it to end. So,
yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. So you're always going to be disappointed by the closer. All right, I can see the logic now.
So the beginning and the end.
And the end.
So is it the beginning and the end?
Well, it was the end of that album. And
the beginning of the next.
Well, you know, I mean, interestingly enough, actually, I mean, I alluded to the fact that I was struggling to adapt to the music industry. And there was a moment in time there where Paul and I thought we've had enough, we're done.
Wow.
After three albums, I'm exhausted and don't want to do this anymore. And that's why some of you will probably know that we wrote, of all the things we've made, that was supposed to be the last song we were ever going to release.
Wow.
To Want This, of all the things we've made. It was just, I wanted to go, I'd had enough. But then I decided I'd come back again.
Good on you, good on you.
And again.
Let's have a listen to Beginning and the End.
Thus we reach the end. The beginning and the end. You see, I could not try and hear the time.
Thank you.
I mean, it's a masterpiece, you know. I mean, you must be really proud.
Do you know what? I have to say, it's been... Actually, I was quite emotional there thinking about that song. And I actually want to say that two thank yous from me for this evening. First of all, this evening is great because you owned this album. So you were invested in it. You know what you're talking about.
Thank
so
you.
It wouldn't be the same without you being able to talk about it personally. So thank you so much.
Pleasure.
So it's been great to be able to have a conversation with somebody who cared about the album.
Yeah.
So thank you.
But
also pleasure. You guys as well, because this wouldn't be the same without having you here personally to listen. I was coming down on the train thinking, I haven't even thought it. Has anybody bought tickets? Is there going to be anybody in the audience? Oh, my. So thank you for being here and sharing this. And I think that... It just goes to show. I mean, we made this album for ourselves, but it resonates so much more when you share it with people who care about it. So thank you.
Yeah, well done. I'm going to ask if anyone has
And you got a microphone. Yeah.
Very serious.
Tim.
Yes. Oh, me.
Listening part. What a brilliant thing you've done.
Oh, just, thank you. Oh, wow. Oh, thank you, man.
Superb.
So kind, thanks.
I just love them. Andy, you touched on it earlier. So you had the massive commercial success of this, which is literally my most played album ever. Just it's reminiscent. It's fantastic. And then Dazzle Ships, which didn't. So how hard... And how much was at stake when you were recording Junk Culture to try and get back in the game?
Oh, there was everything at stake. You know, I mean, this was now, you know, the Midas touch had deserted us. Suddenly it was like, you know, we could do no wrong. And now it was like, oh, we just fell off the cliff there, you know. And we were absolutely gobsmacked. We were just like, you know, well, no, we just do what we want, and then it's a hit, isn't it? You know, because that's what happens. Mm. We got lulled into this false sense of good. Yeah, so consciously and unconsciously, we definitely dialed it back in. I mean, you know, we did, but we needed hits, and it was the first time I think ever in our lives on the Junk Culture album that we sat down and went, we got to have a hit on this record, otherwise we're in trouble. We are going to get dropped. And now, you know, sort of 5 years into our career, we were like, you know, Paul was married, we all had houses, and it was like, oh, this is our job, and it could go away. So, yeah, we were, you know, and I think a lot of people think that Junk Culture album was the tipping point where we started to go in a more conservative direction. And I think that, for me, the great thing is that we came back again. And we said to ourselves in 2007, if we're going to make new music, we're going to do it like we did in the early days. We're just going to do what we want to do. Nobody's going to tell us what to do, because we don't have to sell records anymore. But it's just important that it's good. So I'm kind of really glad that we reformed, because I think the stuff we've done subsequently has been really important. Thank you.
Anyone else got a question for Andy?
You said Junk Culture was quite conservative. I don't think it was. And then you did Crush, which I prefer because I love listening to it in the car.
Okay.
I forgot my question.
Oh.
Actually, my question was going to be about She's Leaving, but you've addressed that because you released that as a single. But how do you work out what you're going to release as a single and what you don't?
Quite often we tend to... require other people to tell us, because we're so close to everything, you know, and we do think we can be Stockhausen and Abba, so we need other people to say that one, you know. I mean, even on the new album, I was surprised when people started saying, no, Bauhaus Staircase, go for it, just go for it, it makes a statement. To be honest, I think we're going to release 6 singles off this album. I think Kleptocracy is going to come out after the album, and the one, if I would pick one song off this new album that was should would have been a hit back in the 80s, it's a song called Look at You Now. It's a Humphreys song with me singing it instead of Paul. It sounds like an updated. It's kind of a cross between Souvenir and Don't Break My Heart by UB40. It's got a great groove. And it's got a pinging melody, and it's pardon? Well, you know, I mean, it's just really scary. Actually, just I mean, just before we release our 14th album, listening to Architects of Morality, I'm feeling like, oh no, is it going to be okay? Is our new baby going to be okay?
It's going to be fine.
But
it's going to be fine.
Yeah, no, generally, it's good to canvass other people's
Dr.
opinion.
Dr. Tim.
Thanks, Dr. Tim, yeah. Calm my blood pressure down, please.
Any other questions?
One here, Tim.
Hi, Lady. Andy.
Oh, sorry.
I actually agree. I think that Punishment of Luxury is amongst your best work.
Thank you.
I was gobsmacked at how a band who have been together for so long can sound so up to date and on trend. Do you find that easy, or is it quite difficult to stay so sort of like up to date?
I think if you get excited about what you're doing, if you can plug back into your energy, which is not easy mm-hmm. after all these years, what I find is like if I get one or two songs and I start going, oh, this is working. Oh, okay, all right, I can still do this. We can still do this. This is going to happen. That's when you get the kind of the vibes going. The one thing that Paul and I promised ourselves was that when we got back together, we're never going to release something unless we think it's ready and it's good and it's done. Because, you know, we did release things for under pressure, needed money, needed to get things out, and, you know, just, and you get, you know, I think you said this about, was it your second album, you struggled to get the songs together
well,
for?
Well, I mean, I understand all those kind of, like, pressures, you know, to get stuff out, and you know, our second record, you know, we had everything apart from songs, you know?
Popularity, attitude, a record company right behind you.
I think we had a couple. We had Weirdo, which was, you know, very helpful.
But
sometimes you forget that, you know, there is pressure to get stuff out. But I suppose that, I mean, we don't put anything out unless we're...
It's nice when you get to a place in your career where you have the luxury of just saying, nobody's telling us what to do. And I mean, one of Paul's mantras is, we don't release a record just to have a new logo on the tour t-shirt. You know, that's the wrong reason. The new album took... I've already said in interviews, this album wouldn't exist if it wasn't for COVID. We were done. We were exhausted. We were tired. I had decided I wanted to smell the roses. Paul wants to go and live in France. He's become a dad again. This is why we've said it's probably the last album. But I don't know. It might change. But it's hard. It's really hard because we are not going to release something unless we really think it's good. So, you know, this reappraisal in our heads of where Punishment and Luxury sat in the canon with your listening person, and you're echoing the fact that people do treat that album as like, you know. I think a couple of journalists have said to me about the Bauhaus Staircase album, they said, you sound like you're still in your 20s. I said, because I'm singing like I care, because I do.
Yeah,
and that's all you can ask yourself to do is get involved enough to care, so it sounds like you care, not just like, this is our 14th album and I don't have anything to say, but I've got to make an album because we're on to tour next year, blah de blah de blah. And it's like nobody sings those words, but some of them bloody well might as well. I'm sorry, mentioning no names, but thank you for what you said about the album.
Yeah. I think with Punishment and Luxury, when I listened to it, I think you were able to distill your sound and edit it down to that which is uniquely OMD. And I think that's why it's probably one of the best you have of your whole catalog. Because when I listen to it, I hear parts of everything, but you've been able to edit it well. Actually, I was going to ask you, I mean, how do you figure out how to edit it so it really is uniquely you and your band and your sound? Because I think that's what I heard with Punishment of Luxury after I'd listened to your whole catalog.
Thank you. I think the bottom line is that you have to trust your own instinct. You think, well, you know, I've done this now for so many years. I know where this should happen. I know where, and that's too long. This isn't working. I need to change it or improve it. You have to be quite ruthless. And particularly with modern technology, you've got so many channels now. It's what Paul and I call the tyranny of choice. You know, you can just go on and on and on. And you just have to trust yourself that you sit down and go, no, that's not good enough. That's the bit we need to replete. That's a good idea. So, yeah, that's all you can say. I mean, I mean, Paul in particular was very nervous about making a new album. I mean, he kept saying, if it's not as good as Punishment for Luxury, we shouldn't release it. And I'm like, I agree, but, you know, let's try. You know, if you don't try, we'll never know. So, you know, just, you know, stick with me on this. You know, come for the ride. Let's trust ourselves. And so I think, you know, when we come to finishing an album, I think the overview in terms of the editing and arranging is me. The finished sound is Paul, because he's better at mixing. He knows what all those things do in the bloody computer. I don't, you know. He knows what a compressor does properly. He knows how to set it up. I just, like, ram the vocal and hope it doesn't distort, you know. So it's... And also, Paul is got a very... I think because I live with the songs in my computer most of the time. Most of the songs evolve in my computer. Once I've got the idea off Paul, I'm the one that's sculpting it. Then when it's finished, I've kind of lost objectivity. I need him to come in with his fresh ears. The only problem then is that we have this fight in the studio where he's trying to be sonically as clean as possible. And I keep going, yeah, it's perfect, but you've lost the feel. Go and make a cup of tea and I'm going to fuck it up a bit more and get some of the vibe back in. Yeah, and we have this constant to and fro where we argue like, really, we really argue. I mean, arguing about the EQ on a kick drum. He's like, it needs to cut. No, it's too clicky. It's too pointy. And I go, no, it needs some grunt. He's like, no. And I said, you're taking out too much 250. Yeah, we bitch about EQ all the time. And I want more reverb and more echoes on things, and he takes them off. And we kind of fight each other. Like an old married couple, we fight each other to a draw in the end. We go, yeah, that'll do. We'll agree to disagree on that one.
I love doing a show where you mention EQ. Yeah, in the show.
Oh, we're going geeky again.
Sadly, we're going to have to wrap this up now. But I'd like to thank Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Andy McCluskey, and Architecture and Morality for tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you to Andy McCluskey for taking me through OMD's Architecture and Morality. Now's the point where I like to suggest a few records that I've been listening to this past week. It's kind of Christmassy, but you might not think it is. It's called The Last White Christmas, and it's by Basement 5. They only made one album, and it was produced by legendary producer Martin Hannett. Dennis Morris, member of the band, leader of the band, took many, many punk photographs in the 70s, including lots of the Sex Pistols and Public Image and lots of other greats. So I'm kind of obsessed by this song at the moment. It's called Drive Me Crazy by Little Yachty. So I'd like to recommend that. It's quite influential on my band, The Charlatans, especially in the early days. Julie Driscoll, Brian Auger and The Trinity. And this one's called Season of the Witch. It's probably come from a best of, really. They also did the version of Wheels on Fire. There was a theme tune to Absolutely Fabulous. And then, as soon as it's OMD, I'll put in something that was mentioned, you know, something that was mentioned in the interview. And it could be any Brian Eno record, really, but I think maybe let's go with Another Green World. Replay any past episodes of my listening party by searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll be able to catch up on every episode of the series: Sparks, the Lloyd Cole, The Bangles, Texas, U2, Kinks, Def Leppard and more. As always, keep tweeting me your thoughts using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. Every song on this episode of my listening party was taken from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark's Architecture and Morality. All songs are by Andy McCluskey and Paul Humphries. The album was released on Din Disc in November 1981. See you next time.
Absolute Radio, telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.